The following is a re-recording of a shiur given last week at the Bayit. The topic is a medical halacha theme, but specifically injections on Shabbos. Initially was going to be injections and acupuncture on Shabbos, but in the wake of the experience of the shiur itself, I think we're just going to confine ourselves to injections and hope that we finish that within the 45 minutes to an hour. There are a few different types of issues that come up as part of this. The first one we're going to deal with is encompassed within the following vignette. Jim, 24, has been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. He takes medication and also injects insulin daily. What issues should Jim be aware of in injecting himself on Shabbos? Now, you can always argue in terms of type 2 diabetes, in terms of what the level of need is for his insulin injection. I'm stipulating for our purposes that he's been examined by physicians who say that missing a single dose will not immediately threaten his life. Long term, it could throw him out of balance and cause problems, but let's for the moment stipulate we're talking about a cholesha'in bo sakana, someone who is not dangerously ill, with the understanding that if you don't accept that the type 2 diabetes case is cholesha'in bo sakana, you can instead use some other case, some other set of facts that will create this. What are the issues that come up in terms of the injection? So when we're dealing with an injection of insulin, we're talking about an injection which is subcutaneous. It's done underneath the skin. You are poking a hole in the skin, but it's not intravenous. It's not done into the bloodstream. We have injections that are subcutaneous under the skin. We have injections that are called intramuscular between the muscles, or in the muscle. That's separate from the intravenous one, which is going to raise a separate halachic problem. So we're just dealing right now with subcutaneous and intramuscular injections. So the first issue that comes up, which will apply, in fact, to all injections, is when you open the envelope that contains the equipment. How do I go about opening that envelope? So for this, it's relatively straightforward. This is not our main topic for today. I'm just going to mention that when you tear the envelope, we avoid tearing letters in the envelope. We try to tear it in such a way that it destroys the receptacle so that I'm not creating a receptacle with a mouth such that I can now use it for future storage of items. Next, I have now opened up the envelope. I am holding a syringe and a needle, which I'm supposed to assemble in order to be able to give the shot. So assembling needle and syringe creates a problem. I'm going to talk about two different situations. First, the case in which you assemble needle and syringe, and then, after that, you are going to dispose of it, breaking them apart. The second case we'll deal with is the case in which you dispose of it intact, which I understand is more common. There's some kind of a cap which is attached to the assembly, and you simply flip the cap over and then throw it out as is. But first we'll deal with the case of the shot that you assemble for the sake of its use, and then afterwards you disassemble it. So the argument is that this might be considered an act of construction, an act of building, potentially makat patish, literally striking with a hammer, which is a term that we use when you take two pieces of equipment that are not functional, and then you assemble them to create something that is functional. Now, Chasim Sofer, in Arachayim Ayin Beis, ruled regarding the umbrella and parasol discussion, that temporary binyan is not binyan. Constructing something for a temporary purpose does not really constitute construction from a halachic perspective. However, there is reason to believe that that will not apply in our case. Take a look, please, at source number one on the sheet. Gemara in Shabbos regarding mita gual nisa, some kind of a folding, assembled bed. Be'er Chama have a mita gual nisa. There was a folding bed in Rav Chama's house, Rav Chama's yeshiva, potentially. Bay can be either one. Have mahagrila biyomataba. And they would set it up on Yom Tov. So Amalei Ahumid Rabbanon LaRava, one of the sages says to Rava, who evidently is a part of the scene in Rav Chama's house or yeshiva, Mai Daitach. What are you thinking? Why do you think that it's okay for you to assemble this on Shabbos? Binyan min hatzadhu. Is it because you believe that this is unusual construction, literally construction from the side? I added in bracket, deino takua, because it's not fixed firmly together? Nihid isura de oraisa leka, granted there is no biblical prohibition in assembling the bed. Isura Derabbanan Miha Ika. There absolutely is a rabbinic prohibition in assembling the bed. So what do you think you're doing? To which Rava replies, Amar Lei, Ana Kravitshim Begamliel Sphirali. I agree with Rabbi Shimon Begamliel, the Amar Imhaya Rafui Mutter. He says that loose construction, as was the case here with this bed, keep in mind people are not necessarily sleeping on the bed. Beds were used to hold things, beds were used as couches, all sorts of purposes. So evidently this was a loose construction, things were not firmly attached. And Rava says, I follow the view of Rabbi Shimon Begamliel, that if it's loose, then the construction is actually permitted. So we are told, though, that if it's not loose, but if it's a real act of attaching things together, even though it's temporary, you put it together and then you take it apart, nonetheless, it will be usur. It will be at least rabbinically prohibited. And Rashi there says that, in fact, if you attach it with force, it will be biblically prohibited. The question will be, when you take a syringe and needle, and you attach them, as I understand it, you take the needle and you put it into the syringe, and then you turn it at the shear. This was discussed. You snap it together. So will that be considered a forceful construction? Take a look at source number 2, please. Gemara also in Shabbos, dealing with a spigot. You have a barrel. The barrel has a hole in it. You want to use the barrel to dispense wine. So you need something that's going to channel the flow of liquid once you pull out the stopper. So haitirfa de asa, a myrtle leaf, which might be set up in such a way, asa, you're not allowed to use it. My time, a wadi. So Rav Yemir midifti amar gzera mishum marzeh. Rav Yemir of 50 said the concern is for a gutter. I added it in brackets the word shayit hakein. You might set up a gutter. You might fix something. A gutter like for a house. In other words, you'll look at this and say, well, if you can set up a spigot for a barrel, why can't I adjust a marzeh, a gutter for the house, which actually is real construction? Rav Ashi, Amar Gzera Shema Yikdom, Rav Ashi gave a different explanation. He said the concern is that you might cut, as in cutting a leaf from a branch. May Benayu, what's the difference between the two explanations? Ike Benayu, the Kata Umanchi, if you have cut leaves available. So the concern for cutting a leaf is not present, that's Rav Ashi's concern, but Rav Yemer of 50's concern that you might come to fix your gutter is indeed a concern. The point is that here, where we have concerns about setting up this spigot, doing this temporary act of construction, and as you go through the discussion in the Gemara, there actually is even, I think I should have brought a little bit of a different section here, the part of the discussion, we end up indicating that there's a chatos to be brought, a sin offering to be brought, even in the case of temporary construction, potentially, not in the piece that I quoted here in source number 2, Bayin Sham, look at the Gemara in Shabbos there, Kuf Mem Vav Mem Beis 146b. There's another discussion also in Shabbos, it's Kuf Gimel Mem Beis 103b, about a pauper digging a hole in which he's going to hide coins. All cases of temporary construction with liability ranging from the rabbinic to the biblical. So when I take the two pieces, the syringe and the needle, and I attach them to each other, am I now liable, in fact, for construction, even though it's temporary? So there are three mitigating factors that the Poskim mentioned. Number one, that Sitzeliezer, or Eliezer Waldenberg, it's brought in source number 3, says that here you are joining two separate items as opposed to changing a single entity. Now, the bed case was also a case of joining separate items, but when you think of the spigot, where you adjust the leaf, or we don't want you to adjust the leaf, that's taking a single item and changing it, maybe that's worse than joining two separate items. That's what's mentioned here in source number 3. Yesh gam lechalek bein tikun beguf hadavar kafi shehema hadugmaos shehevi lebein harkava zmanit dugmat harkavat machad b'mizrach. He said, you might find room to distinguish between fixing a single entity, as are the examples brought that are brought on this, like the case of the leaf that's going to be a spigot, and the case of temporarily joining two separate items together. That's number one. Number two that Sitz Eliezer points out, and it's in the same discussion that I cited in source number 3, that you're disassembling it right away. And because you disassemble it right away, that may actually be less of a problem. Take a look, please, at source number 4. This is his source for that idea. Rosheir Zalman of Liadi, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, in his Shulchan Aruch Harav, talks about different types of temporary construction. He says, "Va'afilu b'klishal prakim," even if you're dealing with an implement that's made of parts. "Dahainu shehit kam b'chozek," and we're talking about where you put the parts together with strength. "Ve'inyan shetzarech lazeh gevura v'umnus," in a manner requiring strength and requiring a degree of craft. "Dareze binyan gomor," that's full-blown construction. "V'chayev mishum bona," and you're liable for building, "im asui lihiskayem harbei," if it's going to last for a long time. So what we're talking about is putting together pieces in such a way that they are attached with force, and it's going to endure for a long time, and that's your intent. That's bona midi oraisa. That's construction, and you are liable. "Vim eino asa lihiskayem harbei," however, if it's not made to last for a long time, "hareze binyan arai," that's called temporary construction, "v'asa midivrei sofrim," and it's rabbinically prohibited. "Ela im kein eino asa lihiskayem klal," unless it's not meant to last at all. So we're defining a new category. There's temporary construction, and there's really temporary construction. And the argument that Rav Waldenberg brings regarding this is that if you're talking about putting together a shot just for the sake of its use for a moment, and then after that you're going to dismantle it, so that should fit into the third category defined by Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and there should be no liability at all. And that's a second mitigating factor. The first mitigating factor is that you are joining two separate items, not fixing a single entity. And the second one is that it's going to be disassembled right away. And then we have a third point. And the Chazon Ish, by the way, brings this as well. The Chazon Ish in Moed, Nun Aleph, Yud Zayin, Dibur Masil Aval, brings this as well. The third mitigating factor is the point raised by Rav Avadya Yosef in source number 5. And that is the fact that you don't actually need any sort of craftsmanship in order to make this happen. If you take a look at source number 5, he says, There is no need in assembling the syringe. There's no need for the act of a craftsman. You don't have expertise and training for this. So there is no biblical prohibition involved. V'od, and further, the practice is that indeed we throw away the needle right after the injection, and so on and so on. So he believes that the argument could be made that since there's no craftsmanship involved, it actually should be less serious. Based on this, Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa and Perek Lamed Gimel, footnote Mem Gimel, permits it, as does the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avram, and Shin Yud Gimel Aleph, noting that according to Shulchan Aruch Rav, it could be entirely permitted to do that assembly, and I see I actually brought that. If you take a look on the second side, in source number 6, the ideal would be to try to use a shot that had been assembled from before Shabbos. Ach im ein kazeh, but if you don't have one with an appropriate needle, mutar gam lechaber mizrach lemachat mat ima, you would be allowed to assemble a shot with an appropriate needle. Okay. I mentioned before, though, that there are two different kinds of shots. We've been assuming that you are assembling it and that you are going to disassemble it right afterwards. But what if you're not planning on disassembling it right afterwards? And in fact, it tends not to be the case. What's normally done, as I said, is that you assemble it, you use it, and you throw it out intact. There's a little cap that snaps forward on it, and then you throw it out. So now what do I do? So the Mishnah Berurah discusses an issue of tying a lulav. Remember that for the mitzvah of the Arba Minim, the four species that we pick up on Sukkot, we require eyed or igud. We require that you bind together the four species. So, kam Yom Tov, am I allowed to tie together my species, the lulav, the hadasim, and the aravos? And the answer, of course, is it depends. What sort of tying are you going to do? Tying, as is prohibited biblically on Shabbos and Yom Tov, refers to a knot, as opposed to a loop, which is looser. So take a look at what the Mishnah Berurah writes in source number 7. The Kasvu Ha'acharonim, the later authorities have written, Hadinoyin Heter Bekesher Echad Lamata, that which we are lenient, if you have a knot, and then you have a loop on top of it, as opposed to a double knot, there's a knot and then there's a loop over it. That assumes that you are going to disassemble it that day. Because it's not craftsmanship if it's a knot with a loop on top of it, number one. And number two, it's only temporary. But if it's plan, if you're planning on having it last, kigon belulav, like with a lulav, there's some debate there. Is that one day that lasting or 7 days that it's lasting? But the point is, if it's something that's going to be left intact, aser lasas kesher lamata ela aniva bilvad, then you have to do only looping. You would not be allowed to do kshira. You would not be allowed to do tying. So writes the Mishnah Berurah. So the statement is that if things are going to stay together, then the leniencies of, well, it's temporary, it's not for an expert, don't apply. Further, the Mishnah Berurah also writes in his Bir Halacha, that's the same author for this, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, some of the Bir Halacha is Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, some of it is not. But this part is, in Simon Shin Yud Zayin, Dibur HaMaskel HaKosher, he says, if you personally intend to dismantle this, but everybody else in the world, when they assemble it, intend to leave it assembled, your personal intent is irrelevant. So if the shot is normally left together and just disposed of intact, the fact that I personally say, I'm not going to do that, doesn't matter. When I put them together, I am indeed going to be liable. Indeed, based on this ruling in the Mishnah Berurah, the Chazon Ish ruled in Orach Chaim in Nun Tes, that he says joining parts of something together for use is prohibited. The Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa that I quoted before, Parag Lama Gimel, footnote Mem Gimel, quotes Shlomo Zalman Orbach, saying that it's no good on our discussion about the shot. If it's going to be left intact, it actually is problematic. Rav Yitzchak Weiss disagreed. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, also known as the Minchas Yitzchak, is quoted from a letter of his in the Nishmas Avram, in Shin Yud Gimel Aleph, saying that lulav is not relevant for our case, because the lulav is left attached for a long time. It's left attached for more than a day. He says that doesn't fit our example. That's not what we're talking about. It's attached and it's used and all of that. He says I don't think that that's actually relevant here. And take a look at source number 8, what he does believe is relevant. The Nira Li says, it appears to me, this is not Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, he's quoting what Ram Gambir, the Magen Avram, Dikosos shalanu ha'asuyim b'charitzim saviv, umuhudakim b'chozek, l'kulei amo osur. He says, we have cups that are made with grooves, and they, you know, if you think of like a champagne glass with a base and something that's going to screw into it. So he says, those things, everybody agrees are prohibited. You can't assemble those on Shabbos, because those have grooves, and you stick them together with strength. And he says, that's not comparable to lids for utensils, like a pot, which are made the same way, they're a screw top. Those are not made to last that way. You open them and you close them. You open them and you close them. In other words, there is a concept of assembly which is done powerfully, which is nonetheless attached and removed. So therefore, Yitzchak Weiss says, you know what? I really view the shots in that way. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, I don't understand. He's also quoted there in the Nishmas Avraham and Shin Yud Gimel Aleph. He says, I don't understand. Why is this analogous to the lid? The lid is meant to be removed. Again, the shot is something that people leave together. So Rav Shlomo Zalman rejects that argument and says, no, the lulav analogy actually is the appropriate analogy. Rav Yitzchak Weiss, though, argues that it should be permitted for other reasons. He says, when the shot is assembled, he evidently believes, he says, that you're not really using strength to do it. Even if you're snapping it into place, apparently, you're not considered to be using strength. He refers you back to the discussion we had in source number 1 about the mita gwal nisa, this bed that's attached together, and Rava's statement that construction is permitted if it's going to be loose. The Chazon Ish ruled in Orach Chaim, Nun Yud, that where it's loose, it's permitted entirely as well, and even if it's attached, just not with real strength, it's no worse than a Derabbanan, no worse than a rabbinic prohibition. Rav Weiss says, you can't have a rabbinic prohibition here. He says, the reason why I would say you have three categories, loose, attached, and attached with strength. He says, attached with strength, we agree, is biblical. Loose, we're saying, is permitted entirely. It's this middle category that the Chazon Ish says is rabbinically prohibited, where it's attached but not with strength. But Rav Weiss says the idea of applying rabbinic prohibition doesn't relate in the case of the shot. The reason for the rabbinic prohibition is Shema Yitka. The concern is that if you're going to tell me that he's allowed to do it by attaching it, even without strength, then he might come to attach it with strength. So you don't want that, therefore we say there's a rabbinic prohibition, don't attach it even without strength. However, for the shot, there is no way to attach it with strength. There is no further option. This already is the strongest possible bond. And therefore, the rabbinic prohibition is irrelevant. There is no consideration of lest you attach it with strength. It's entirely not germane. So that's Rav Weiss's position. He says we have grounds for leniency from the fact that it's not done as a strong connection. Rav Weiss also sees grounds for leniency in the Rambam. If you take a look at source number 9, the Rambam talks about the issue of fitting a reed tube into a barrel to work as a channel. He says, "Ein cholchin shvaferish l'kanim neishuk mitaking kli." At source number 9, you're not allowed to cut a reed tube because that is fixing the kli. Haisach hatucha, if it was already cut, aha pishena mitukenet, even though it's not fixed. It hasn't been adjusted in any way. Mutter lach nisa benekev hachavis b'shabes. You're allowed to simply slot it into the hole in the barrel and so produce wine. Ve'nechoshin shamiyatakim. We are concerned lest you fix it. So he says the Rambam permits, and indeed it's brought on the Shulchan Aruch and Arachaim Shin Yudalid. Hey, that you are allowed to insert a reed for a spigot. So Rav Weiss says, if I'm allowed to put the thing into the barrel, and we're not worried you're going to fix it because this is already designated that way, it's set up for that purpose. The same thing is true with the syringe. There's no concern about fixing it at all. It's a temporary use. Leave it be. So Rav Weiss is Megill of Shlomo Zalman is more machmir. So the Nishmas Avram says that if you have a need, you would be allowed to assemble the shot, even if normally it is left assembled. And in particular, you should intend, despite the fact that we said your intent doesn't matter, you should intend that assembly to dismantle it. It would be better if someone who wasn't Jewish would be the one to assemble this. So it appears. So you have your equipment. You have the needle and the syringe. Hopefully they were attached before Shabbos. If they weren't attached before Shabbos, hopefully they're the type that people do normally take apart immediately after use. But you have your needle and syringe. Now you want to give the shot. Now, I actually, in the course of the shiur, when I first delivered this, I discussed another possibility, and that is that you have a reusable needle which needs to be sterilized. My understanding from the physicians who are at the shiur is that this isn't necessarily so applicable in terms of the types of shots that we are talking about. But just to mention it at any rate for people to be familiar with it, the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa discusses the issue of boiling the water in Perek Lamed Beis, chapter 32, Seif Samach. He says that you should ideally use water that had been boiled before, so that it's a rabbinic prohibition, according to many authorities. It would be best if it hadn't cooled entirely from that boiling before Shabbos. He also notes he shouldn't sort the tools. What about boiling the needle? So the Tzitz Eliezer discusses this in several spots. He discusses it in Chelek Ches. And what you want is Tshuva Tes Vav, Perek Yud Dalet, Sif Ka'an Yud Gimel. Also in Chelek Yud Gimel, it's in Tshuva Mem Hei. Siv Gimel, and also in Chelek Tes Tshuva Yud Zayin Perek Beis Siv Lamed Zayin. So he has numerous discussions about this issue. The Tzitz Eliezer of Waldover contends that boiling the needle may actually create liability for mevashel, for cooking, because the needle softens. Or Shlomo Zalman says, come on. He says, melting the needle is impossible in the water. That's number one. And number two, if you're going to tell me I am concerned that in heating up a needle, you are going to end up on some level of significance melting the metal, then how am I ever allowed to put a ladle into a kli rishon, into a pot that was on the fire? So the Tzitz Eliezer, or Waldenberg, argues that those cases are not comparable. He says, first of all, you should know it gets close to 400 degrees Celsius. I don't know what kind of an autoclave he was researching, but that's what he said, that the needle actually gets to the point of 400 degrees Celsius, at which the physicists do say that the metal undergoes some degree of softening. And that's number one. Number two, he says the cases in which hachazara is permitted, where I'm allowed to put the ladle into the kli rishon, involve lesser temperature and may actually be clay. It may be pottery. It may not be talking about putting in metal, in fact. And there's room for this discussion, but again, I don't want to go into it at length because I've been told it's not so relevant in practice. One thing to know, though, is that Tetz Eliezer offers grounds for leniency. I brought it in the sheet in source number 10, and that is in a hospital where a lot of people are, in fact, dangerously ill. And the needles that are in the autoclave, or any other equipment for that matter, are not individually assigned to that patient. So the argument could be made that that you can take one of the needles for your purpose, going with a Halil argument, essentially, saying that, well, since some of these needles are for patients who are dangerously ill, the whole thing becomes permitted. Okay. What about measuring when you load the shot? Now it's time for you to load the insulin, so you need to measure. So the Shemir Shabbos Kehelchasa, it's in Perek Chavtes, Siv Lamedes quotes the Mishnah Brura in Shin Vav, Lamed Vav, explaining that measuring for medical purposes is permitted on Shabbos because it's for the sake of a mitzvah. And the decree against measuring, lest you write down, never applied to mitzvah measuring. So therefore that's okay. An interesting discussion in its own right, but not for right now. So I want to sterilize the spot where I'm going to give the shot. So how do I get my cleaning material? So the Tzitz Eliezer has a discussion in volume 13, it's Chelek Yud Gimel, Tshuva Mem He, Si'if He. He discusses the possibility of tearing cotton from a bunch and whether that would involve liability for tearing, cutting off a precise unit or not. But in practice, people get these pads that are pre-done. So the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa in Perek Lamed Beis, Si'if Nun Tes, wants you to avoid cotton that has absorbed liquid in it, because when you press it, then you extrude the liquid, and that's called sechita. You are taking a solid and pressing it in order to produce liquid from it. So he doesn't want you to do that. What he wants you to do, and what Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg recommends as well, in Chilek Yud Gimel, Tshuva Mem He, Sif Dalid, is ideally there are a few different ideal recommendations here. So the Tzitz Eliezer's ideal recommendation is that you use some kind of a pad or whatever that has a handle. I imagine if you hold it with forceps, that's similar, or use a non-absorbent material. That would be the absolute best to avoid concern for squeezing out the pad. And the ideal, though, according to the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa that I cited before in Paraglamic Base, see if Nuntes, is pour the liquid onto the site and then dry it and then just throw out the material. What he's accomplishing, I should really unpack this and explain it a little bit more. We have two separate concerns. One concern that we have is schita that I mentioned already. Concern is that you're going to press the pad in order to squeeze out liquid. That's one concern. The other concern is laundering. You're washing the pad, cleaning the pad itself. So in the event that I don't press down, and I distance myself from pressing down, I reduce the issue of schita, of squeezing out. The other idea, though, is to still avoid the laundering concern. So if I'm throwing out the material, if it's a disposable material, then I certainly have less concern for laundering, particularly because this isn't water. It's a liquid that's not a laundering liquid. So it's less of a concern. But again, the ideal is to irrigate the site and then wipe it dry with the material, preferably non-absorbent material, and throw out the material. Okay. Now, I'm going to actually give the shot. What about the fact that I'm making a hole in the skin? Is that a concern for construction, making a hole? Whatever, the answer is no. The Yisodei Yeshurun, Gedalia Felder, in Chelek Gimel, is page 304. That's Tzitz Eliezer in Chelek Tes, Tshuva Yud Zayin, Perek Beis, Siv Lamed Vav, quotes the Chazon Ish. It's no issue because the hole closes, and you want to have the hole closed. You don't want the hole to remain open at all. He also writes, and Tzitz Eliezer writes in a separate response, Chelek Tes, Tshuva Tes Vav, Perek Yedalad, Siv Yud. He says that he saw in a journal, Hapardes, from 1957, that somebody pointed out there's a microscopic wound. And he said, okay, that's very nice. We don't care about microscopic things. He also writes, also the Tzitz Eliezer, in Chelek Gimel Tshuva Mem Hei, that he's not concerned about potential blood clots, because it's not a guaranteed thing that it's going to clot. He says a good phlebotomist can prevent clots, and it's certainly not your intent. So even if it does clot up in a visible way, that's she'enu tzricha legufa, that's not something that you desire, it's not part of what you're doing, and it's not a guaranteed result, and that's fine. Not that blood shouldn't clot in a wound. Blood clotting in a wound is fine. The concern is lest you make some kind of a bruise, whatever, and he says again that that's not supposed to happen, and it's not a guaranteed result. So the upshot is, you tear the envelope open carefully. Ideally, you use something that's pre-assembled, or you use one that will normally be disassembled right afterwards. In the event that that's not possible, you yourself, as you assemble it, plan to disassemble it immediately thereafter. Ideally, you have someone who isn't Jewish to assemble it. That would be even better. If you're working with a needle to be sterilized, you do have separate concerns about heating that. And how that should be done, and if anyone has that situation, you know, feel free to ask separately. I just realized that I didn't, because I'm just re-recording this shiur, I didn't state my standard disclaimer, but I will state it now. All practical questions should go to your shul rav. I'm happy to discuss halachic issues, but practical questions have to go to the rabbi of the shul. Continuing in terms of how you're giving the shot, you measure to load the shot, that's fine. You sterilize the spot carefully, ideally by pouring on the liquid and then wiping it clean and throwing out the pad, and you're home free. That's in terms of our first vignette, and the diabetic patient who's getting the insulin shot. What about an intravenous shot? So here we introduce a new problem, an example of an intravenous shot for Chulish Embo Sakana, for a non-dangerously ill patient, may be a patient with trigeminal neuralgia. They're suffering from great pain. That was not for this case. I scratched that. That's for a third discussion, which I'm not even going to end up getting to. Sorry. Read the wrong notes here. But you have an intravenous injection for somebody. I had a possible vignette, but let me not get overly complicated here. The concern that arises when you're dealing with an intravenous shot is that the physician may aspirate blood in order to determine that the shot is set properly within the vein. Now, let me clarify what I mean here. When you insert a shot intramuscularly, you're putting a shot in the muscle, you might draw back on the syringe in order to draw up fluid to ascertain that there is no blood there, because you don't want to be in the bloodstream. If you're injecting epinephrine and you inject it into the bloodstream, that is very, 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 very bad. And so you aspirate, hoping that there is no blood there. On the other hand, when you do want to inject intravenously, you do want to put it into the vein, you pull back again, and that's called aspirating, in order to make sure that it actually is in the vein. Two different practices. There you want blood to come out. In the case of the intramuscular shot, that's fine. You can do the aspiration because you don't want blood to emerge, and blood isn't supposed to emerge. The concern is, what about where I'm injecting intravenously and I do expect to produce blood? I want to, in order to determine that my shot is in the right place. Am I allowed to do that, or is that a problem of chovel, of wounding somebody, drawing blood from their body intentionally? I should also note, we're not talking about where there's a cannula already in place. In other words, where the hole has already been made and there's something there keeping the hole open in the vein, you don't end up aspirating blood. The question is only you're putting it in for the first time. Someone comes to you at your house and they need this shot. They don't have any sort of hole in place, you know, being held open. That's what we're talking about in this conversation. So, the prohibition in the Torah is chovel, is wounding. Chovel is considered, according to most authorities, to be a function of shochet, like shechting, which is under the general malacha, forbidden task of netilas neshama, of taking a life on Shabbos. That includes not withdrawing blood from a living creature, even if I am not actually taking a life. If you take a look at source number 11, Tosfos in Shabbos, he says that the liability is for tolda de shochet, that's a form of slaughtering. Under the general issue of taking a life, when you remove blood, it's like taking a life, because the pasuk says, the Torah says, "Hadam hu anefesh," for blood is life. The Rambam disagreed. The Rambam says, and we're going to come back to this later, it is important, that the Rambam actually says that this is not under netilas neshama. The Rambam says that it's under mifareik. Mifareik is to separate parts of a solid in order to withdraw. In order to break it down, I should say. In this case, you are breaking up tissue when you produce blood. If you take a look at source number 12, the Rambam writes, Hadash kigrogeres chayiv. If you thresh a fig, a dry fig quantity, you are liable. Ve'in disha ala begidulei karka. But threshing is only a concern regarding things that grow from the ground, because that's the sort of thing that you thresh. V'hamefarek, harayu told us, hadash. But a descendant form of it, a subcategory of threshing, is mefarek, where you break apart a solid. And if you were to wound a living creature who has a skin, you would be liable for mifarek, for breaking up the skin tissue of that entity. Assuming that your goal is to get the blood that's going to come out of the wound. If you only intend to harm the creature, then you're exempt from liability on the laws of Shabbos. That doesn't mean this is a good thing to do. It just means you didn't break the laws of Shabbos, yashar koach, because it's only a destructive act. But what is that talking about? If you wound an animal, if you wound a beast, if you wound a bird, something like that. Because there's no psychological element to what you're doing, we assume. We assume that what you're doing in wounding the creature is either you want to get to the blood, or is a completely destructive act. It's one or the other. If you want the blood, that's called chovel. Then it's prohibited. If you don't want the blood, it's purely destructive. You're not biblically liable for breaking Shabbos. Aval, however, the Rambam continues, Hachova b'chaveiro, if you wound another person, Aval pishnis gavei mahazik, even if your goal is only harm and not to produce the blood, Chayav mipnei nachas rucho, then he's liable. Someone who does that will be liable because he gains satisfaction. The assumption is that psychologically a person gains a certain catharsis in hitting a human being, which he doesn't gain from hitting an animal. So the Rambam believes it's actually prohibited under mifareik. That's the prohibition against wounding. Whereas most authorities believe it's actually not. It's under Netilas Neshama, drawing of blood. But that distinction is going to matter, so keep that in mind. Let's assume for the moment that our issue is Netilas Neshama, that our issue is taking blood, which is an element of taking a life. So there are two mitigating factors that authorities bring which might make it okay for the doctor to aspirate blood, knowing that blood is going to come out, hoping, in fact, that blood is going to come out, even though it should be wounding. Number one is you don't really want the blood. The blood is simply an indicator that the shot is in the right place, but you don't want to draw blood. And that's brought by Rav Gedalia Felder in his Yesodei Yeshurun in the fourth volume, pages 165 to 167. It's brought in the Tzitz Eliezer. It's in volume 9, Chelek Tes. It's Tshuva Yud Zayin, chapter 2, Se'iv Lamed Vav. Both of them say, so it's Dirabbanan, since I don't want the blood. It doesn't mean it's permitted, but that reduces it to a rabbinic prohibition, and all sorts of leniencies are then attendant. However, Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa in Perek Yutes, Seif Nun Hey, reports from Yecheskel Abramsky that in fact it's Delraisa, it's biblical. But I don't want the blood. Yeah, but wanting to withdraw the blood for the sake of using it as an indicator will count just like wanting it for the blood itself. In other words, wanting the blood as an indicator is just like wanting the blood for use of the blood itself. I should note here that clearly he's not going to be happy with, no one here is going to be happy with, the idea of taking blood for a blood test, because then you definitely want the blood for the blood's sake. There may be grounds for leniency, we'll see in a moment, but right now it's a real problem. The second mitigating factor, or potential mitigating factor, is one that will apply to the blood test also. And that is the difference between what's called Chiburei Michbar and Mifkar Pakeh. There's a discussion in the Gemara at the beginning of Ksuvos as to two different types of wounds that one might make. One is a wound in which there's blood absorbed inside tissue, and you break the tissue and the blood comes out. That's called Chiburei Michbar. It's joined with the tissue. Then there's a separate situation in which blood is stored inside in some kind of a receptacle inside the body, such as, I don't know, a blood vessel. And then when you poke a hole in the wall of the vessel, the blood comes pouring out. But the blood was not absorbed inside tissue and then produced from that. And then maybe I could say it's not called chovel. So here, you poke the needle into the vein, the blood is blood that was inside the vein, not inside the tissue in the vein in any substantive way. Yes, there is some small drop of blood from that, but that's not really what I'm going for anyway. I don't want that blood. The blood that I want is the blood that's actually inside the vein itself to show that the needle is in the vein. So based on that idea that Tzitz Eliezer and Chelek Tess, Chav Ches Yud, is willing to say that maybe this issue here of aspirating the blood is not that bad, because you're not taking the blood from inside of tissue, therefore it's not really chovel in the true sense. It's not called wounding in the true sense. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach said no. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach was strict because of the position of the Rambam. He says, go back and look at what the Rambam said in source number 12. The Rambam talked about the difference between wounding an animal and wounding a human being. And he said that one is liable biblically for wounding a human being just for the sake of satisfaction, even though he doesn't actually need the blood. So he says, ignoring the concern of, well, is the blood really absorbed in the tissue or not absorbed in the tissue, leaving that aside, he says, the bottom line is that you, in this case, you are drawing blood. You're drawing blood for the sake of using the blood as an indicator. That's no less real than drawing blood for the sake of the satisfaction of drawing blood from somebody. And so he says, based on that, this should still be on the biblical level, and your statement of, well, it's not really absorbed within the tissue, is not sufficient to draw it down from being on that level of biblical liability. The Tzitz Eliezer argues with him in Chelek Yud, Tshuva Chav Hei, Perek Aleph, Si'if Aleph. He argues that maybe it would that you could push this point, but the bottom line is that Rosh Shlomo Zalman is very strict about this issue of aspirating blood. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg does have some grounds for leniency. There's more to see on this. There are tshuvos in the Shevet Halevi over Wozner, tshuvos over Shlomo Zalman and Smith HaShlomo. There's also a separate consideration, the consideration that it might form a bruise, although again, that's not necessarily guaranteed. As a matter of halacha, the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa in Perek Lamed Beis, Si'if Nun Ches, excuse me, says that the intravenous should really be avoided. If at all possible, you should avoid the intravenous shot. If, however, the intravenous will be better or faster in its effect than the intramuscular subcutaneous shot, you should use the intravenous. The Tzitz Eliezer in Chelek Yud Gimel, Mem Hei Beis, says that it's really better not to do it. It would be an Issur D'Rabbanan, it would be a rabbinic prohibition. But again, if you're stuck, and we don't mean life-saving. Life-saving is always going to override. That's not even a discussion. But in the case of a Cholesh Evo Sakana, who's not dangerously ill, he says really best to avoid doing that, but if you're stuck, it would be, he says, you could rely on the leniencies that we brought. That's for the intravenous shot. What about treatment that's not directly therapeutic? What about a vaccination? So the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa in Perek Lamed Beis, Si'if Samach Beis, says that vaccination for somebody who might otherwise contract an illness on Shabbos would be permitted. I don't know what kind of a case you have that a vaccine operates that quickly, but that's what he says. He says it would be permitted. The Tzitz Eliezer brings a case, which, and maybe this is the case that the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa is dealing with. The Tzitz Eliezer in Chelek Yud Zayin, Tshuva Tesvav, talks about someone whose tetanus vaccination might have lapsed and who now has a dirty wound. So he says you absolutely give him a new shot. Absolutely do. What about morphine or some other painkiller? What about that? The Mishnah Brura discusses pulling a tooth. It's the Ramah in Orachayim Shin Chav Ches Gimel, the Mishnah Brura in Shin Chav Ches Yud Beis. They talk about pulling a tooth purely to cure pain. And they say a Jew cannot do that. You can't do that on Shabbos. You're violating Shabbos biblically. And that's not permitted for someone who's simply in pain. You're not curing some bad illness. So can the argument be made then that the same thing should be true for morphine? So Shlomo Zalman discusses this. And he says that this is true. However, bad pain could endanger a patient. And therefore, he says, there would be grounds potentially to say that if giving the painkiller will extend the patient's life, this should be permitted. And this discussion is brought in Shmir Shabbos Kehilcha Subparaglon, the base footnote 150, Kufnun. What about a shot that is for nutrition? So the Shmir Shabbos Kehilcha in Lamed Beis in Nazayin says that if you have a patient who is dangerously ill and you want to improve his general condition by giving him a shot, he needs some kind of intravenous nutrition, you can do that even though it's not to treat the actual illness. You're not actually giving him the shot to treat the illness. You're giving him the shot in order to give him the strength he needs to fight off the illness. And that's similar to the argument brought regarding morphine, and it is considered to be a justification. I'm not going to get to the acupuncture discussion, as anticipated, so that will have to continue on another day.